You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, November 15th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Michael Barnes, Bennis, excuse me. History lecturer at Yale University, author of For Might and Right, Cold War Defense Spending and the Remaking of American Democracy. Meanwhile, heeding us our call on Friday, the Department of Justice enforced his congressional contempt. Steve Bannon, three-shirt-wearing Steve Bannon, surrenders to the FBI after a grand jury indictment.
They only have one shirt in prison.
We'll see about that. Meanwhile, Kaiser Union strike avoided as a deal is struck in the middle of the night last night. Would have been tens of thousands of pharmacists going on strike. In Texas, Beto to run for governor. Meanwhile, in New York State, Zephyr Teachout, try one more time for attorney general. And you won't have Patrick Leahy to criticize anymore.
Hey,
hey. He's going to retire at the spry old age of what is it, 80-something?
Yeah, and the front runner to replace him is 75?
Yeah. Yes, a young spring chicken. Nah. Meanwhile, Biden to sign the infrastructure bill today. The reconciliation bill punted to December. But they're going to get that defense bill done. U.S. apparently hid airstrikes in March of 2019, which killed dozens of Syrian children. And new emails show just how much the Trump administration and Trump himself interfered with the CDC COVID response. Interesting stat, the number of workers quitting their jobs in September was the highest on record. COP26 ends with a thud, and the White House holds the first summit of tribal nations since 2016. Wonder why that is. All this and more on today's program. Not sure why Ronald Reagan made a guest appearance at the end of that, but
I ain't even there.
It is Monday, and of course, here to start off the week, and actually be here the entire week, as she is always, Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma.
I will be here this entire week. Next week, not so much.
Well, that's true. Next week is Thanksgiving week, as we call it.
Yes, it is.
So that's pretty
what we call it around here.
We call it around here. Actually, during Thanksgiving week, we're going to have at least four shows. Well, no, a maximum of four shows and a minimum of four shows. We're going to have four shows.
Just four shows, yeah.
They're not going to be all live, but, I mean, and we're not going to do one on Thanksgiving.
Right, but we give you content, even when we can't physically be
it's
here.
Ridiculous.
Content machines.
We're machines.
Yeah.
We're machines. I mean, well, that's how we end this show. We reveal. That's the reveal. I'm not sure when it's going to happen. Could be probably years and years, but I mean, it's going to be one of those things where I just
take off your face like a la Terminator.
Yeah, something like that. One of those futuristic sci-fi. Yeah.
Right, or like fembots, like awesome powers.
The
Sam especially.
The Bannon thing is, I mean, putting aside the fact that it's Bannon, The important thing is that Had the Department of Justice not upheld this contempt of Congress, sent it to a grand jury, the grand jury decided, there would have been a complete destruction of the ability of Congress to perform proper oversight, not just in the context of people who are plotting to overthrow the government, as the January 6th Commission is investigating, but people who are like sort of not looking to overthrow the government, just control the government or to poison citizens or whatever it is. And so this is really important for two reasons. One, it empowers Congress's ability to investigate. Hugely important. They need the ability to hold people in contempt if they won't come and testify. Whether it's like tobacco executives or Facebook executives or Google executives or Steve Bannon and Mark Meadows. I mean, we're going to start to see a cavalcade of this. And I'm here for it. Plus, it's, I think, very important to understand what was going on and who was plotting what. And the only way you explain to the American public the severity of these things. And I'm also, like, in the back of my mind, I'm also thinking about these emails that were released about how the White House was dealing with the CDC in their attempts to warn people about COVID. I mean, I think there is a case to be made that there are, you know, tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people died who did not have to die.
Deborah Birx said as much.
Yeah.
Right? Did she not exactly say that as a part of the task force that, you know...
Is some of her testimony?
I forget exactly in which context, but I believe she said the Trump administration's policies resulted in an extra thousands and thousands of deaths.
There's a difference between policies that were mistakes... Do you understand?
Yes.
And policies that are set out specifically with a total reckless disregard for the lives that were going to be lost. And it is the latter. And I think that is becoming in more and more clear that they actively inhibited the ability of the CDC to respond in the way that they needed to respond to this.
I mean, that was obvious. Trump was basically saying the more testing we do, the more cases we're going to find. So we shouldn't do any more testing. He only saw it through the lens of how the PR was going to be for
it's
himself.
Better not to know.
And there, you know, and I think there was, without a doubt, and I think, like, you know, there was a feeling of like, well, we'll let the, you know, maybe what they're doing is letting the old man blow off some steam. In the meantime, we're going to be doing everything we need to do.
The adults behind the scenes are taking care of it, right?
And it turns out, no, adults actually were being basically told, like, you can't do this. We're not going to let you warn the American public. And it is, I mean... This administration, I mean, talk about January 6th, that's all well and good. I would like to see, and obviously these CDC emails are coming out because, but I would like to see that committee forefronted. And I would like to see subpoenas issued there. And I would like to see, like, you want to talk about, you know, show trials. That's what we should be seeing. But getting back to the January 6th, what number was that again? Nine. Senator John Barrasso, Republican from Wyoming, sat down with ABC's George Stephanopoulos this weekend. And George Stephanopoulos, I don't know how Barrasso didn't prepare for this, but there's audio of Donald Trump saying it was common sense that people would be angry enough to hang Mike Pence. Now, in any other context, I would probably agree with him. I mean, obviously, I'm joking. I think Mike Pence is loathsome, but I would probably just jail him. Right. I wouldn't resort to that type of thing.
Make him do some work.
Make him have dinner in a room with a woman by himself.
Exactly. Exactly.
Just put mental torture, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Yes.
We're going to tell your wife that you ate in a restaurant full of women. What do you think about that? But nevertheless, here's Senator John Barrasso, unable to really respond to what Stephanopoulos is presenting him.
Were you worried about him during that siege? Were you worried about
no,
his safety?
No, I thought he was well protected, and I had heard that he was in good shape. No,
you heard those chants. That was terrible. I mean, it was, you know, the...
He could have... Well, the people were very angry.
They're saying, hang my...
Because it's common sense. How can you... If you know a vote is fraudulent, right? Yeah. How can you pass on a fraudulent vote to Congress?
So he says, hang Mike Pence is common sense. Can your party tolerate a leader who defends murderous chants against his own vice president?
Well, let me just say, the Republican Party is incredibly united right now, and it's because of the policies of this administration. And I think the more that the Democrats and the press becomes obsessed with President Trump, I think the better it is for the Republican Party. President Trump brings lots of energy to the party. He's an enduring force. Elections are about the future, not the past. And that's what we saw in Virginia and all across the country. And the Republican policies and the Trump policies of a strong economy and American energy, not begging Vladimir Putin to produce more oil, which is what Joe Biden is doing. Those are policies that we're going to continue to run on in the future.
So you have no problem with the president saying, hang Mike Pence is common sense?
I was with Mike Pence in the Senate chamber during January 6th, and what happened was they quickly got Vice President Pence out of there, certainly a lot faster than they removed the senators. I believed he was safe the whole time. I didn't hear any of those chants. I don't believe that he did either. And Vice President Pence came back into the chamber that night and certified the election.
Well, we just played the chants. I'm asking if you can tolerate the president saying, hang Mike Pence's common sense.
It's not common sense, but there are issues of every election. I voted to certify the election, and what we have seen on this election, there are areas that needed to be looked into, like what we saw in Pennsylvania. We all want fair and free elections. That's where we need to go for the future.
Well, you know, as he's talking, it honestly felt like someone had John Barrasso soundboard, and they were just struggling with the only responses they had.
The sequencing
was they just didn't have anything to actually address the question.
So what he says there that's most notable is Trump brings a lot of energy.
Apparently.
Yeah. Well, I mean, cool, right? Then there's no reason to, if it's in your self-interest and you're able to ride it, there's no reason to actually tamp it down in any way.
But Stephanopoulos, I'm annoyed that he went about the chance and not the question of was the vote fraudulent or not? Because
They're
in the Schrodinger's vote thing of it was a fraudulent vote or it wasn't. We eventually let Biden win. But ask about that. Do you think that vote was fraudulent? Because how people reacted to a fraudulent vote when Trump says, if you know a vote is fraudulent, well, we don't know that. That's a lie.
The next question should have been, well, if it was not common sense, why? What was the underlying? Yes, it would be nice if they really just, set out to really, really make these politicians address this thing that is existing 11 months after the election.
Our big lie.
Yep. Part of the issue, too, is that Pence seems okay with all of this, right? I mean, Mike Pence isn't speaking out about this kind of quote.
Yep.
They're all okay with whatever energy Donald Trump brings, even if we're playing with fire, obviously.
How many hours a day do you think that Mike Pence practices responding to this question for the Republican debates? Well, I'm sure Donald is was my president, and he's a quite a guy. And, it's a turn of a phrase, I'm sure.
Yes. Well, I mean, he...
Don't leave me hanging.
Are we sure they didn't
do leave me hanging?
Hang me, right? Hang me as the next president?
Right.
In the rafters?
Hang 10? I mean, come on.
He can't practice that in the mirror, though, because looking at himself in the mirror is obviously one of the seven deadly sins.
Is that illegal?
No, I don't know. I'm just trying to find fake but real sounding puritanical beliefs of Mike Pence.
Yeah, I don't think the mirror... I have a feeling he spends a lot of time in front of
the
mirror.
I don't know if he even shows up in the mirror, to be honest.
Folks, our sponsor today, Podium. If you own a business and you know that there are not enough hours in a day to waste playing phone tag, list of customers you need to reach doesn't get any shorter, especially when business is good. That's why local businesses everywhere turn to Podium. Podium makes every interaction as easy as sending a text. So everything that makes your business great can get done faster. Podium isn't just a better way to communicate. It's a better way to do everything. allows you to gather reviews, collect payments, and even market to your customers. Podium makes it all as easy as pressing send. You won't just free up more time, you'll grow your business and get more done. With Podium, you'll close deals with customers before the competition even has a chance to call them back. Join more than 100,000 businesses that already use Podium to streamline their customer interactions. Get started for free at podium.com/majority. Or sign up for a paid Podium account and get a free credit card reader. Restrictions apply. That's podium.com/majority. If you got a small business, check it out. Get directly in touch with your customers. Okay. I want to welcome to the program Michael Brannes. He is a history lecturer at Yale University, author of For Might and Right, Cold War Defense Spending and the Remaking of American Democracy. Michael, I'm here with Emma Vigeland. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
All right. So you're telling the story really of the past, I guess, 80 years, more or less, yeah, and the development of what, I guess Eisenhower in some ways had warned us of was this military industrial complex, mm-hmm, and the intellectual history and the sort of the political history of it. Let's start with, you know, and what's amazing, we're on the verge of passing another defense bill, I don't know, within a week or two, and it's just gonna happen. We'll probably add a couple, 10-20 billion dollars, which we now would refer to as like $200 billion over the next 10 years, and no one's gonna bat an eye. Will you just go back to the era prior to the Cold War to give people a sense of how this was not always the case? This country was not an empire, both in terms of like its reach and its expenditure.
Sure. So when the United States emerges from the Second World War victorious, there, as you're indicating, Sam, there's not a clear sense of where the United States is going to go with its foreign policy. There is a sense that the Soviet Union will be a threat, and communism might be a threat, but the post-war era that we consider coming to be in the late 1940s, early 1950s, that shapes the military-industrial complex isn't a given. And it's what I argue in the book. It's really liberals who see that the Soviet Union is going to be, as they view it, an imperial threat to its interests, both economic, that is the United States interests, economic, diplomatic, and military interests. And there's a fear that the United States will not be prepared militarily, economically, and diplomatically to meet that threat. And obviously the Second World War is looming in the background here. And to prevent another type of World War II, many people in Congress, but Democrats in particular, as well as some Republicans, get on board with this idea of its military power at home and abroad, and needs to do so in ways that will deter a threat from the Soviet Union, a Soviet attack. And then... Go ahead. Sorry. Yeah.
No. And I also just want to mention, like, you're frozen, but we have audio seems to be coming through fine. So that's okay. That's fine. Don't worry about it. If we get the video back, all the better. But I just be clear here too. Like, give us some definitions when we talk about, because, I mean, I recall a time you know, you had George Herbert Walker Bush, I think, announcing in the early 50s, we're all liberals. So give us some definitions as to who those people were at that time. And so that we know, like, when we're talking conservatives, liberals, Democrats, Republicans, who we're talking about.
Sure. Liberals are referring to our Harry Truman, who's president of the United States at the time after World War II. But many what we call Cold War liberals, those who believe that the United States mission needs to be, foreign policy wise, needs to be brought in the wake of a Soviet threat. And those liberals include people like Hubert Humphrey, who is a Democrat from Minnesota, who's very dedicated to civil rights and social justice, but believes that the United States can't carry out social justice without having an expansive empire to deter the threat of a Soviet attack, which would obviously thwart America's global and domestic ambitions. And they believe that so this is the kind of the project then for many Democrats is that in order to build up its economy domestically, it also needs to build up its foreign policy globally. And what this means is that you have in the wake of McCarthyism and Cold War anti-communism, you have a situation where many liberals who are pushing for healthcare, full employment, those liberals, as they're being confronted with red baiting, as they're being confronted with their own concerns that we can't pursue any policy that would smack of socialism, that they can deliver social benefits, jobs, good paying jobs, even racial progress through defense spending. And so what happens is you have the
let's stop there for a moment, because that, sure. I mean, is really sort of the fascinating, maybe the unintended consequences on some level, that we see from this era. So where is where are conservatives situated here? Where are Republicans situated here in the wake of World War II? So if I hear you correctly, you have liberals who are both, are they both concerned about expansion, or I should say fighting the Soviet Union, fighting the Cold War, and providing material benefits at home? And we'll get to that story in a moment about how the mechanism for them to provide that material benefit, sort of like, how can we dovetail this in there? Where is the conservative and Republican sort of stance on this, and how much, how much are they cornering the liberals on the Cold War hawkishness into that corner, or how much are they just simply there with them?
So you have divisions within the Republican Party, divisions within conservatives in general in the early Cold War. So some Republicans believe that the United States needs to have a military, have a presence globally, but that it has to be limited. And they're particularly keen on the Air Force. People like Robert Taft, who's a Republican from Ohio, would not be considered an isolationist by any stretch of the imagination, but believes that the United States can't be building toward what he would call a garrison state, right? Like military bases, which is basically almost, to a certain extent what we have, military bases around the world, an employment program that it relies upon defense spending, defense plans throughout the country, building weapons. That's not good for the health of the democracy or in Taft's major concern, the health of the fiscal health of the nation. So there are those Republicans like Taft, but there are also those who are more nationalist Republicans who believe that communism is a threat internally and globally, and they're willing to do what needs to be done to spend certain amounts of money, but more in terms of ideologically do what needs to do what they need to do, stamp out communism. At the same time, what's happening though is that liberals are pushing for these big changes to government, and then the conservatives are red baiting the liberals, who are saying, "Well, if you're looking for these big changes, this is reeking of socialism." And so they're trying to play all sides of the Cold War to a certain extent. They're saying, "Well, liberals are spending too much, but we also need to spend more on the Cold War, but we can't spend too much." And so what happens, I argue, by the early 1950s is that Republicans and Democrats kind of come together in this bipartisan consensus that really shapes how we think about Cold War spending today. Going to your point about the fact that there will be an over $700 billion defense budget that's passed, in the coming weeks, and that'll be a bipartisan project. And as you said, no one will blink an eye about that. This is where this moment kind of occurs, in this bipartisan consensus is in the early years after World War II.
And just to be clear, so the deal is, we will all support this Cold War, and the Cold War will end up being a sort of mini welfare state that we, you know, this is how we can get our, our Iceland or our Finland or whatever it is, our Scandinavian social democracy. We're just going to call it the military.
Yes. Dude, I mean, so that's the default, right? When you can't get what you want on healthcare, when you can't get what you want on employment, or when you can't get a welfare state, that is what many European countries, as you're alluding to, like the UK and France, and Scandinavian countries are building towards. When you can't get that in American context, what happens is defense becomes the default. Defense jobs create good paying jobs when they're many cases unionized, and provide people with a stable livelihood. If you're talking about unionized jobs, you're talking about good healthcare, you're talking about living in good neighborhoods. And so defense spending becomes a project of social and economic uplift for many Americans, but particularly for those who are the top income earners, those who have the education and the capabilities to make the most from this this sort of economic regime.
And how much of that came from the draft going by the wayside, where conservatives saw an opportunity? I mean, how deliberate was it to provide an alternative to the social safety net created under the New Deal, and under LBJ as well, later, I guess, moving into the 70s and such, to say, okay, we can provide an alternate vision, and one that kind of promotes American militarism?
Yeah, so the draft ends in 73, 74, the transition to the all-volunteer force, and there's a good book by a historian named Jennifer Mittelstadt, who focuses on the military welfare state, which she focuses on the Army, and says that really, if you look at the Army and the benefits that the Army is providing in the wake of the draft, it's akin to a European welfare state. Part of that that's in the act of enlisting in the Army, enlisting in the military. You get money for education, you get money for living stipends, things like that. But so that project is in tandem with mine that I'm looking at in the book, which is by the 70s, the mid-1970s in particular, what starts to happen within defense spending within the military industrial complex is that the best jobs, the good jobs, go to the elites, right? So you have this decline in working class, a decline in a manufacturing base. And what that entails largely is the scientists, the engineers, those with PhDs, those with good paying jobs, reap the benefits of this larger transition towards austerity or neoliberalism. And so what you have are two things happening at the same time, right? So you have the fact that people are going into the military, trying to find jobs after they leave the military, trying to find benefits from the federal government. But at the same time, this is a project of working class uplift, but then those who are benefiting from the defense industry do so in very smaller terms. But it's one that we have to sort of examine in the larger decline of the working class, and how the defense industry contributes to this larger problem.
All right, so I want to just put a pin in that, the sort of, if I understand correctly too, the parallel of there being wealth inequality developing in non-military society in civilian life, and also being exacerbated by essentially the training and the stratification within the military as people exit the military. I want to go back to the 60s, and the 50s when was there a sense, and we're talking about like people like Galbraith and others, and obviously, politicians at that time, as they were under, you know, and how conscious was this deal that they were making of like, we can't get, you know, like was there a plan in their mind? Like if we can introduce the idea of a GI Bill, right, which is basically like free college and government run healthcare and full integration, racial integration and, housing. if we can introduce this in the context of the military, it will eventually bleed into the rest of society. Was that like the thinking, or was it, I mean, what was the thinking of that? And was there some type of like timeline? I mean, was there anybody who said like, you know what, we were wrong 10 years ago at one point?
I didn't see any sort of deliberate decision making in my research. So the real problem that in particular Democrats confront is that they get pushed out of office by 48, 49. They're not a dominant force in Congress. And by the 1950s, you have a Republican president. And he, that is Dwight Eisenhower, as much as he's a critic of the military-industrial complex in 1961, he, in the 1950s, is a critic of government spending overall, but allows the defense industry to flourish in many parts of the country. The defense industry expands from the north, going into the south and into Texas and into California. And so what happens is that you have a situation for many people, Democrats and Republicans, in Congress, that is, who see that their constituents are clamoring for jobs. They want the jobs that were there during World War II, good paying jobs through defense. They see during the Korean War in particular that there are jobs going to certain localities and certain places that aren't going to their districts and their towns. So they're lobbying various officials. People are lobbying various officials in Congress that then is putting pressure on Congress to generate jobs, generate larger employment through the defense industry. And so when you have this decline of the larger social welfare project that really doesn't emerge until LBJ and Great Society in the 1960s, by that kind of time, it's too late, you know, where defense has kind of taken over as a large sector of employment generating growth in the United States. And you've got a hollowing out of the welfare state due to McCarthyism and due to Cold War anti-communism. And so it becomes this normative way of how we think about politics. But by the time we get to the 60s and 70s, there's no political vision left to consider how we could move away from a militarized economy in any way. And many of those people who were campaigning or arguing for that, people like Henry Wallace in 48 and others have gone out of politics, or they've died. So that failure of a political vision that really gets picked up by the new left and the anti-war movement in the 60s, but fails for reasons maybe we can get into. But that by that point, it's kind of too late. The transition has already occurred.
I mean, it's... in many respects, it's an incredibly tragic story, right? I mean, it's just sort of like you opened up a Pandora's box and now it's over. Let's talk about what happens as we go into the 60s, and there's an attempt to push back on the militarism in here. And I should also just say, I think there's a good point to note. I don't know if it was in the introduction of the book or early on in the book, you talk about Chris Dodd and Sam Gagenson. Yep. And EB and the Electric Boat. I went to school in New London, Connecticut. Used to watch General Dynamics. Used to watch these nuclear subs go up the river. I did some work for Gagenson during it, which was still during the Cold War. And then we see the transition. I wasn't around by the 90s in Connecticut, but we see the transition of Gagenson from someone who is arguing against Ronald Reagan's expansiveness of the Cold War, or at least maybe just rhetorical. I don't know if it was actually like it was pretty expanded by that point anyways. And then by the 90s, after Reagan is gone and the wall has fallen, they've got to worry about the sort of material deprivation or benefits that are going to come that happen with that. Do we still need the same nuclear subs that we needed when there was a Soviet Union? And somehow they come to yes, just because there's a lot of jobs associated with that. And there was a lot of economy in that area around that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's the story. I begin the book with the end of the Cold War. The end of the story is the beginning of the book, because you're right. We enter a period where there really is no need. There's a talk of a peace dividend in the late 80s and early 90s at the end of the Cold War. And you start to see, you know, Democrats who are, as you're saying, critical of Reagan's Central American policies, critical of the SDI, the Strategic Defense Initiative, which is this, you know, Star Wars, which is this missile defense program that just goes nowhere and just generates a lot of money and jobs for defense contractors. They're critical of these projects. But when it comes down to actually eliminating elements or relics of the Cold War in their districts, nuclear submarines at Electric Boat and other places, you see Democrats flipping. And this is one of the reasons why I think this institution is so powerful, because it outlasts its interest, right? Its security interest. It serves a larger purpose for generating employment in a time of austerity, when people are looking for jobs, looking for benefits, and the government is not providing them, and corporations obviously aren't providing them in the ways that deliver the jobs that are needed in the country. So this is a part of a larger story of the relationship between domestic and foreign policy in the wake of the Cold War.
Was it, I mean, I imagine it was both push and pull, right? I mean, that has left us, if we were to map all of the military industrial jobs in this country, physically map them, they would be sort of like, just spread across the country, almost like you would, you know, I don't know, put cream cheese on a piece of on a bagel or something. They're just like all the way across, and yep. And distributed that way. Was that both push and pull? In other words, was it like Congress people saying, like, we've got this, you know, they want to build, you know, some defense hawk wants to build a helicopter. Well, I'm going to the company, you know, Grantham Northrop or whoever is building this. I'm going to go to them and say, like, you got to put a plant in, you know, my district. And if you do, you got my vote. And then some other congressman says, well, we'll make the rotors and you guys will make the and that's how it works. Right. It's like a sort of a push and a pull.
Yeah, to a certain extent. I mean, I think you have certainly as the Cold War defense industry is forming in the 50s and 60s, you have a very deliberate effort by particularly people, congressmen, they're almost all men in the 50s and 60s, who are clamoring for defense contracts in the district. There's one famous example of a congressman from South Carolina named Mendel Rivers, who had the nickname of Rivers Delivers, because Rivers was, you know, the key proponent of defense spending in his district in South Carolina. He was, you know, just advocating for more military spending, more military defense plants, more bases, to the point that one of his colleagues said, Mendels, if you put one more military base in your district, it's going to sink into the Atlantic Ocean. You know? So there's a deep need, desire for politicians to benefit from this. But of course, as you're saying, well, then these jobs come in and then people, it's a zero sum game, right? Like you get a defense contract for this part, but you're not that defense contract when it runs out, when the, you know, the machine or part or a plane or whatever is built, then that contract is limited and people want the contract again. And then people who are benefiting from that lobby, their representative lobby, write letters to the president, and looking to get what they had back. And then when it's a zero sum game too, you have people saying, well, people like Mendel Rivers, he's getting all these defense contracts. What about me? And they're looking to also benefit from this as well. So there's an effort by Congress to bring defense into these districts. There's then a pushback from people on the ground who are benefiting from the defense industry, whether they're employed by it or not. If they're serving coffee or you know, working at a store that's frequented by defense employees, then they're going to benefit from this too. They're pushing back for more, and so it's this zero sum game that really shapes how we think about politics and the way that defense spending and foreign policy affects our lives in these material ways.
And so as we enter into the 60s, and the early 70s, there's a pushback. There's an anti-militarism, at least in this country. But does that have any material impact on how we spend money? And I mean, is there, do we ever get a contraction in this, in a sustained way during any period since we built it in the 50s?
Not in the sense of ebbs and flows to defense spending. So in terms of GDP, for instance, defense spending never is equivalent to what it was during World War II. It was when 43% of GDP, and then the Korean War, it goes up to 17% of GDP. Vietnam, it's 9% of GDP, and now it's about 4 or 5%. So in terms of GDP, it's never equivalent. And I take that into account in terms of how I think about defense spending, as people aren't benefiting economically in the same ways that they were during World War II, and they're trying to get that back. But in terms of the actual increasing of the numbers of the defense budget, it doesn't go down in any significant way. In fact, it keeps going up. In terms of the actual numbers, now, of course, the current fiscal year defense budget is over $750 billion, and that's the largest it's ever been. So it doesn't go down. But the new left in the 60s and anti-war movement, what it does is it doesn't necessarily affect the material circumstances, but it draws attention to the ways in which the military industrial complex produces waste and inefficiency, and can be a contributing factor in terms of maintaining a Cold War economy and Cold War foreign policy in certain ways. And you see in Congress, for the first time really during the Cold War, Democrats and Republicans too, to a certain extent, feeling that they need to cut certain programs. They need to cut these planes that aren't necessary anymore. They need to, there's this one plane called the C-5A plane that has the wingspan the size of a football field. That's producing waste. Lockheed almost goes bankrupt in 1971 because of that. And there's this overwhelming critique of the military industrial complex that shapes how we think about defense spending. But what I argue is that by the mid-1970s, by 73, 74, when there's an overwhelming crisis in the economy produced by many reasons, but inflation and through a lack of oil production, and there are other reasons too, but and unemployment, then you have a greater clamoring for the defense industry to bring back jobs and for people who are employed by the defense industry to keep jobs. So the new left has this real, and the anti-war movement has this real key moment and forceful moment in shaping American culture in the late 60s and early 70s. But it doesn't make an impact materially because it can't do that within this larger, growing, creeping context of austerity that the country is facing in the early 70s.
And then we head into the 80s. Ronald Reagan, of course, is, there's a whole new sort of era of militarism. Although I also remember, there was also like, we just paid $75 for, or, you know, like $100 or $250 for a hammer. That was like the big, that was the sort of, this is how we're going to deal with the military. We're just going to change the procurement or we're going to make it look like what we're doing is cutting down on waste as opposed to the entire thing is wasteful.
Yeah. I mean, that's the famous, what, like $5,000 toilet seat or whatever it was in the Pentagon, I think. The point, though, is that the cost overruns are endemic to the industry. Like it's supposed to function like that. That's a product of the privatization of military spending. There are some people, you mentioned Galbraith, like James Kenneth Galbraith, who said, well, we should just nationalize the defense industry, just take it over and then get these private interests out of the business of war. And then you can really determine when national security is necessary or when you need to produce certain weapons for national security reasons, right? Which arguably during the Cold War are certainly limited, right? And I think that that's one thing to think about, but is how these industries sort of extract funds from the Pentagon. And there's no oversight, right? There still is no oversight in the Pentagon, as much as there's been calls both by Republicans and Democrats to create some sort of watchdog group that could see how the defense industry is just taking money from taxpayers and spending it on these ridiculous programs, like, you know, I mean, the F-35 is one example too, right? This is this big example of a plane that's being produced that is not going to, you know, overall benefit national security interests, and we're spending billions of dollars on it. I think if there was some sort of democratic accountability for that, then you would obviously have greater push on the industry to change things and for the Pentagon to change things. But there isn't, and I think Reagan is one of the reasons why there isn't that you know, those institutions created, why those people don't exist to actually challenge the power of the industry.
Is 9/11 the other reason? I mean, because we're 40 years out now, and I mean, if I was to meet a stranger, you know, if an alien was to come down and say, like, yeah, no, we had this massive buildup of our military because the United States was afraid of the Soviet Union, and then one day they were gone, like literally. And so what did you do with all that money? We just kept spending it. We just kept trying to find a new
big bag.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, that's what's amazing about it is the sort of the durability. There was that brief hiccup where it was like, we're going to have a peace dividend, and people were talking about, we're going to recalculate the GDP. I remember there was that movement that was like around that time in the early 90s. And then, I don't know, Bill Clinton just is consumed by his scandal, and the politics seem to go away. I mean, or just people get excited about Y2K, and then we're on to 9/11, it feels like.
Yeah, I mean, 9/11 is a transformative moment. I mean, what's really interesting to me is, I mean, 9/11 obviously changes defense spending in the military-industrial complex and how we think about war in obvious ways. But, you know, in the 90s, there's this, you know, question, as you're saying, of what do we do with this military? Like, what do we do with these programs? What do we do with these bases? And there is, by Clinton, some measure limited, but to close military bases, there are some bases closed in California and converted, you know, to shopping malls and things like that. But what you start to see in the 90s, and I didn't get this too much just in my book, but I've written about this in other places, and there are other scholars who are writing about this as well, but is the transferring of Pentagon equipment to police departments, right? This is the 90s, is what do we do with this, and the militarization of the police. You get the 1033 program in 97. You get the Budget Enforcement Act in 1990, which prevents defense funds from being allocated to social welfare projects. You know, all this sort of question of like, what strategically do we do with this now we don't have this enemy? And that, then we should obviously consider that in the context of humanitarian intervention and other questions that arise from America's involvement in places like Somalia, for instance, and, you know, and other parts of the world. But anyway, you know, this to me is really interesting and shapes the coming of 9/11, right? The 90s, the militarization of the police, the militarization of American culture, the militarization of American society, where you start to see our police departments looking like, you know, having tanks and looking like they're prepared for war. And then 9/11 happens, and then you have the creation of the Homeland Security Act, the Homeland Security Department, that's going to shape how people in the national security apparatus go after suspected terrorists. And you know, the 90s, I think, is this key formative moment that transforms defense spending both at home and abroad, and really comes to shape us in ways that I don't think we reconciled with yet, now that we're supposedly emerging from the war on terror. But, you know, that's
let me ask you a really unfair question. But like, I mean, you know, it's one thing to sort of, during that era, you know, we're really talking about from, you know, an 8-year period, right? From the fall of the Soviet Union to 9/11. And there is a sort of almost like a scurrying around to try and figure out how we're going to respond to this. You've got the neocons, you know, talking about their project for New American Century and, you know, developing the idea of this sort of lighter, military that can go in and stoke low level conflicts so that we can continue to maintain our hegemony as a hyperpower and allow all these low level conflicts sort of keep everybody busy. Absent 9/11. how sustainable would that have been? I mean, because it feels like, you know, you can get away with it, the fumes for, you know, a decade maybe. But at one point, people are going to look around going like, wait a second. Why are we spending $600 billion maybe at that time? I don't remember exactly what it was. But why are we spending hundreds of billions of dollars a year of this? And there's no enemy. I mean, there was probably an attempt to, you know, sort of build up China as some type of, but certainly not, you know, in the early aughts. I just don't think we were there yet. Where we, like, do you think that could have been a time of reckoning? And I ask only because, you know, how far out do we need to be from these incidences till generational change starts to ask questions that you know, mm-hmm. that Joe Biden couldn't possibly ask because he's living in a completely different era?
I'm actually more optimistic about substantive change, you know, now than I ever was. I mean, I think what you've seen with the response, the public response to the war in Afghanistan, what you've seen with the creation of certain organizations like Quincy and there are others, people who were liberal internationalist hawks on foreign policy, questioning their premises. I mean, albeit limited, but still, those signs are good. I think if you don't have a 9/11, to go to your original question, if you don't have a 9/11, I think what happens is you get another sort of, you know, 10, 15 years of the 90s, where you get larger concerns over humanitarian efforts, like humanitarian intervention, right, in the wake of Bosnia and other efforts. I think there's George W. Bush is not, as a president, is not keen on, you know, overall, if there was no 9/11, reducing America's military presence abroad. I think you'd still find ways in which, or he'd find ways in which, American forces could be deployed and kept in bases throughout the world. But I think what we've seen in the wake of 9/11, which Afghanistan and Iraq turned into, is quote unquote humanitarian wars wars for humanitarian intervention to prevent, to create democracy, even in the case of places like Iraq, and the backlash to that, I think that really it's a formative moment, I think, when people realize that project is ill-fated. It's not going to work, and maybe we should start thinking about how we spend money on the military and where we send our forces. I'm concerned that clandestine operations, special force operations, will continue, but obviously the drone campaign will continue, but I think there's an opportunity now within American society and with the national security apparatus to really start to think how we don't need this in the same way. I mean, spending in the same way.
But does the impetus, but it has to come hand in hand with expanded social welfare programs, because this is almost like, it's almost like the Green New Deal, right? Where it's like, if we're going to, I mean, it almost feels like that we need to have the, you know, in the context of dealing with climate change, we need to have jobs that are waiting for people who would otherwise go into coal. We need to have a whole new, jobs or some type of production of whatever it is, windmills or solar panels or Civic Corps or whatever it is. Like, we need those things. They need to be shovel ready on some level before we can contract, right? Or, I mean, I'm just talking from a political standpoint. If I understand what you've written here in terms of the way it developed, these things have to happen in concert.
Yes, and that. And also that the defense industry can be used to develop those things, right? I mean, you've had all this investment and political will into creating this national security state for employment. But there's also been a project to convert defense spending to peacetime purposes, to civilian purposes. And this is like basically what AOC and others have talked about is like using defense contracts or things that would go to the Pentagon for peacetime purposes and reallocating the defense workforce. There's already a significant portion of the defense workforce that gets involved in these civilian type projects, like that deal with climate change. Why not just, you know, reallocate those things? And I think the failure of Biden's imagination, political imagination, is that, you know, he is saying, well, we need social welfare. We need infrastructure spending, for instance, is a key example to compete with China. Right. But this is why it's needed. It's to make sure that China doesn't, quote unquote, eat our lunch. Whereas others, myself included, would say, well, why do we have to have those two things being the case? Why do you have to have a justification for domestic spending in foreign policy terms and international terms? Why do you have to create an enemy to do that? And I think many Americans would argue that you don't need to do that, that the concern is at home and creating jobs at home and using what we already have at our disposal, which is this vast industry that creates jobs for these peacetime purposes, for these civilian purposes. And a Green New Deal can be part of that, but there could be other measures as well. And there's been activists out there who are already thinking about this and been mobilizing around defense conversion for decades now, and they should be called upon too for this effort.
It'll be nice when we don't have politicians who were literally raised in the Cold War and who have still had this mentality. All right, lastly, let me just ask you about this aspect of wealth inequality, which you began to talk about how we have these parallel tracks, you know, as we all of these things happen, as we sort of like our economy becomes much more neoliberal, and that enhances the need or the expediency of providing social welfare through the military, which grows the military. And then the military itself also enhances wealth inequality because of you have two tracks of people who go in, people who come out of the military who are trained to go into positions where they make a ton of money, and then others who are not trained and, you know, end up just getting stuck in sectors that have absolutely no growth in terms of wealth. So where are we on that accord?
I mean, to me, the problem is that defense industry actually, as you're saying, exacerbates inequality, and that's not changing anytime soon. The demand for innovative technology to compete with China, that's not going to demand a manufacturing base in the same ways that you know, I think would entail during the Vietnam War or during World War II. Maybe I'm wrong on that, but I think that you have this larger hollowing out, as I said, of the welfare state and people who are getting into jobs, looking at the military as a place of mobility. That's not going to change anytime soon. Those incentives are still going to be there, but looking through the military to create employment, I think that, as many politicians say that they're doing, like, this is why they need to keep these jobs. I mean, they keep these jobs because if we don't have these jobs, then people are employed, we're all going to be worse. When they talk about jobs, they're not meeting jobs that blue collar families, that working class families enjoy. They're talking about jobs that go to a certain sector of the population that's largely the economic elite. I think that has to be taken into account when we hear somebody say, well, let's create jobs through the military. Like there's been many studies on this. One key study by Brown University and the Cost of War Project that shows that the way that we create jobs through the military is inefficient. And I think that creating less incentives for people to fight wars through this welfare state, or getting access to a welfare state to fight wars, I think is going to entail, as you said earlier, a project that creates that the government creates jobs for people in the working class. They don't have to go and fight wars to go to college or to have a stable livelihood. I think the way in which we figure out that equation and tackle that, the relationship between inequality and military spending, I think, is going to shape how we conduct ourselves both at home and abroad, and we'll see how that takes form. But again, I'm encouraged now than I ever have been.
Well, I'll take that. For Might and Right, Cold War Defense Spending and the Remaking of American Democracy, we'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Michael Brenes, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
All right, folks. Majority Live. Majority Live. Majority Report Live. .com. Either one of those is
where
you go.
Recreate January 6th.
That's right.
18th.
January 16th, Boston, Massachusetts, the live show. We're gonna slowly roll out who we we're having to the to there. Some massive names.
Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
Steve Bannon handing himself over to the authorities really threw a wrench in our in our booking process.
Bannon was supposed to. Well, whatever.
We don't know if he'll be available anymore.
But folks, you got to get your tickets now. Majority Live may have sold out. Like, there's still good seats. Let's put it this way. There's still, I mean, the Wilbur is a great theater. If you wanted to get really close to the stage, I don't, I mean, but it's an intimate place. And so, get your tickets now because you don't want to be sitting in the storage rooms. Let's put it that way.
Where I have to project really loudly.
Exactly. MajorityLive.com or MajorityReportLive.com. Also, don't forget, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member today at JoinTheMajorityReport.com. When you do, you not only support the free show, you get extra content. And there's even more of that, where that's coming from. We're developing some stuff on the app, which is going to be member-only stuff.
Mm.
Yeah, we're going to get into it. You know, now we get the... We've unshackled ourselves. We're drowning in only one pool now, as opposed to the two pools of largesse that we were associated with, right? We were like, big Comcast is now gone.
Oh.
And and we have more time now to concentrate on those things. Although I have been sort of like chilling a little bit, recovering from those months. It was a lot of work.
Swimming in two pools.
Swimming in two pools simultaneously.
I don't even know how you do that.
Mm. I built a tunnel in between the pools and also justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. You want to, I am the show, go to majorityapp.com. Majorityapp.com. Jack Sunmuns says, Jackson Munns says, the audio on the app is always quieter compared to YouTube. I have to crank it up on the app and it's still not that loud. Interesting. Well, we appreciate the note. We will
probably fix that.
We will fix that. Get a lot more where that came from in the fun half of the program, ladies and gentlemen. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian Media Universe?
David Griscom and I, for Left Reckoning patrons this weekend, talked to one Aaron Kowalski from Nebraska Kowalski about all things farming, the future of farming, the current predicaments of farming. We talked a little bit about that IP stuff, talked about land use, talked about where we need to go for climate change and how we can get bison and do some land back stuff in the middle of the country as a way to... Kowalski's got a good... some good interesting ideas. Like, it's like greenhouses near urban areas where you can get the labor more easily, and we'll do this thing where I can't remember exactly what vegetation you plant, but it pulls carbon out of the environment, and then you send that down the Missouri and Mississippi and then bury it under concrete, and it's basically like an organic way to take carbon out of the atmosphere. So
interesting.
It's got some interesting ideas. So patreon.com/leftreckoning for the first Left Reckoning farm report.
All right, folks, see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, back, back. Back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar! What a fucking nightmare!
Nightmare.
Can you breathe that in, DJ
Denner? Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation,
DJ Denner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
You see, white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
Lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them!
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on.
Black.
Come on.
Black.
Come on.
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.